The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday afternoon space show. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And it is a sort of a quasi-holiday day with Columbus Day. So I hope everyone out there is enjoying themselves. And it's a good and safe holiday for you if you get to observe it. On with our program today, I think it's going to be very informative, educational, and certainly interesting. You can call our program, and our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember, there are no call screeners, so your call goes right into the board, and just be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I'll also answer your call during the break, so don't let that stop you from calling. And then again, don't do, please, what you usually do, which is wait till the end of the show to start using the phone lines, because we will have an on-time program today. And if you do want to call and talk to our guest, you've got plenty of time to do so. Don't wait for the 11th hour. If you want to use email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com, and that's the best address to use for today. Do visit our website. It is thespaceshow.com, so you'll find our detailed newsletter there. You can't miss it. It's in the middle of the page. So it has all of the details of the week's programming, and it has all of the guest bios, and it's the only place where you'll find our future events section. So please do check it out. And if we make announcements to change our schedule or to get something out to you that is important, it will appear on the website newsletter first, which is right there on the website. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter from that location, and it goes out early Monday morning by email. And it, again, it's one or two lines about the week's programming, guaranteed that it will not clutter up your inbox. And all of our programs are archived, going back to 2001. We're coming close to 2,000 programs, so you can download them or listen to them right off of our website. There is a guest search tool which will enable you to do global searches and find your favorite space term or space guest, or to see if someone has been on the guest. Just jot down the dates, and then you can pull those programs up on our archive search engine via the date. There's a Space Show store on our website. Do check it out. Lots of social media buttons there if you're interested in Facebook and Twitter feeds with the Space Show or LinkedIn. And then also you'll see Support the Space Show. Do please remember we are a nonprofit 501c3 educational foundation, and we're associated with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We exist because of your generosity and support. We thank you for it. If you have any questions or comments about supporting the Space Show or the tax deductibility blah, 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 of your gift, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then also remember, we do podcasts, and you can find us in iTunes and Microsoft Zune and a host of other places around the web. Finally, we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they help to promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get lots more information from their website, which is www.swfound.org. They are also the sponsors of our webinar series, and we have one on the 28th of October, and then again November 25th, and maybe one more this year. We will let you know if that materializes. So let me tell you about today's program, and I'm really honored to introduce to all of you Dr. Catherine Conley, who is NASA's Planetary Protection Officer. Dr. Conley received her Ph.D. from Cornell in 94, did postdoc work with a fellow position at Scripps Research Institute, studying proteins involved in muscle contraction. In 1999, Dr. Conley became a research scientist with NASA Ames, and she actually had an experiment on the Columbia shuttle that had its accident, and her experiment, the 14th biological research in canisters, actually survived reentry. And we can talk about that because that has a lot to do with why she is over in planetary protection at this time. And some data was actually recovered from that experiment. In 2006, Dr. Conley was appointed as NASA's Planetary Protection Officer in their Planetary Protection Office at NASA HQ. Their website, if you want to see what they're doing over there or follow along with us, is planetaryprotection.nasa.gov. So do check it out. Dr. Conley, welcome to the Space Show and to a tongue-tied host today. How are you?
I'm okay. Thanks very much. Very nice to be talking with you.
Likewise with you. Let's start out with a definition to put us all on the same page for planetary protection and to not get it confused with planetary defense or other terms floating around.
So planetary protection is the activity of, or the effort to prevent contamination by Earth life of other locations that might be able to host their own life and where we might want to go study Earth life or study their own life as opposed to Earth life. That is, if you're going to Mars, don't bring Florida and find it when you get there. And also, in addition to going out to other places, we are concerned with the process of bringing samples from other planets back to Earth. And the point there is to make sure that we don't bring something unpleasant that might cause harm to the environment of the Earth, i.e. don't cause the Andromeda strain.
So when I guess the only thing that not too many things have come back, but was anything ever found in bringing back anything from the moon, including the astronauts or things with dust on it? Did we have any real concerns? Because I know they had sterilization and they lived in a trailer for a while. And what was our experience there?
Yeah, at the time of Apollo, it was called planetary quarantine, with the idea that it was resembling the sort of quarantine that you might do from ships of various sorts going different places. And on the Apollo missions, we learned a lot about how to do planetary protection better than they did it on Apollo. The efforts for Apollo were designed based on the understanding of medical processes and the microbial world at the time. In the 1960s, of course, we knew a lot less about both of those things than we do now. And so the idea that you might be able to prevent diseases by putting people in little containment chambers for 2 weeks is perhaps better understood now than it was then. And in addition, we now understand that there are microbes everywhere, including all over your skin, many more of them than they understood during the Apollo program. So all of those equipment that they took up to the moon and brought back was not didn't have much effort to reduce the amount of Earth life that was on it. So in fact, when we brought the camera back from the Surveyor 3, and this is something that was mentioned at the time and recently, there was a report that, oh, we saw live microbes that survived the round trip up on Surveyor 3 coming back on one of the Apollos. Whereas if we actually look at the films that were taken of the sampling of that Surveyor 3 camera after return, we discovered that that was probably Streptococcus mitis that came out of somebody's nose who breathed on the camera just before they took those samples. So we learned a lot about things that we can do better, and it's always good to have a first example to learn from.
And these microbes, and these are so hardy that they can survive in space or the lunar environment or the trip back. We don't understand that. How does that happen?
Sure. That's actually exactly the point. We do know that there are microbes that can survive being exposed on the outside of the space station. Bacillus subtilis, or bacillus of various species, the spores of those organisms can be put on the outside of the space station or the outside of a satellite. And as long as they are shaded from the ultraviolet light of the sun so they don't get sunburn, those organisms will survive. But those spores have a very durable coat. They're very resistant. We know that they can blow around in the dust storms on the Earth. So those are the kinds of organisms you might expect to be able to survive exposure to the space environment, and we've shown that they can. Streptococcus mitis, on the other hand, comes out of your nose. It likes really nice, hydrated, comfy conditions, and to put it on a, if you sneeze and let it sit out on the counter for a long time, it will actually die. So it's unlikely that particular organism was contaminating that camera for round trip.
So the absolute cold, the temperatures are not what would do it in, it's the radiation?
In fact, cold temperatures are quite friendly to organisms. When you go take cores out of glaciers, you can find organisms that are hundreds of thousands of years old and survive for that long buried in the ice. So cold temperatures are not a problem. They just sort of freeze everything in place. Hot temperatures are a problem. They would cook the things.
Fascinating. So when they talk about we want to do a Mars return trip, for example,
mm-hmm.
Is it necessary? I mean, I've heard, well, let's bring the Mars items to the space station because that keeps it off of Earth and keeps it safe, and then have our lab on the space station to figure out, you know, what this stuff is or if there's anything bad on it. Is that a good idea? Can you actually bring something back, say, from Mars to Earth and protect from what you're bringing back?
It is certainly possible. We have the technology to contain samples on Earth. We contain things like Ebola virus all the time and study them. So we know how to study things in containment. It's a little bit more of a challenge to keep the Earth life off the Mars samples. That's something that we'd have to develop special containers for, robotic hoods or something. But we have a pretty good idea of how to handle things cleanly because we do that in silicon chip environments. Bringing things back to the Earth and keeping them contained, both to protect the samples and to protect the Earth, is something that is technologically feasible. It's just a question of working out the technologies. We know we have them already. Bringing things back to the space station is a little bit more complicated for a couple of reasons. The first one is that, of course, the space station will fall down eventually, and we don't know how to sterilize it. If it does fall down, we know that things can survive the reentry events. Unfortunately, my experiment demonstrated that. So putting something hazardous on the space station and calling it that safe is sort of a bit of a misnomer. It will fall down. We can't necessarily control when it will fall down, and so that's really not a very good idea. Also, in order to contain something on the space station, because, of course, you have to protect the people who are working on it, who are up there, you have to put all the technology that we know how to do on the ground up in space, in microgravity and all of the other constraints, plus the up mass and just the cost of bringing it up there. And so that's actually also probably going to be a much more expensive proposition than just containing things on the ground. And finally, when you've got the people up in space handling these samples that are potentially hazardous, if you have a breach of containment, are you really going to trust them not to tell you that they had a breach of containment and not just try to come down and have a beer anyway? This is actually something that we observed in the lunar receiving laboratory. There was a breach of containment on some of the lunar samples. So the technicians who were handling those samples were exposed to lunar materials during the quarantine period. And a couple of them just skipped out of the building before they had the chance to bring the guards over and put them in quarantine.
So you mean they ran from it?
They didn't want to go into quarantine. They wanted to go home to their families and have a beer. Yeah, so there's multiple reasons why putting things up on a space station for containment of returned samples is really not that good an idea relative to just bringing them back to Earth where we already know how to do all the stuff.
Okay, so another thing I hear from various guests is one of the reasons to have settlements or facilities on the moon is we can use the moon as a high-risk containment lab for Mars and other places. So is the moon any better than the ISS?
Well, the moon isn't going to fall down anytime soon, so in that respect it's better. But we do still want to we anticipate the potential for having some kind of commercial activities on the moon, potentially space tourism. So really, if you contaminate the moon, then of course you'd have to use all the quarantine procedures, all of the containment procedures between going to the Earth to the moon and back, as we now have in place, although we haven't used them yet very much, for Mars. So you really want to keep the Earth and the moon as one system, simply because that makes it easiest for all the activities we anticipate wanting to do on the moon. Whereas if you suddenly contaminate the moon and you have to do all of your containment between the Earth and the moon, that will make everything much more expensive.
Now, before we started our discussion today, I asked you about your Columbia experiment, and you actually said that's what got you interested in planetary protection. Can you tell us about that?
That's what got planetary protection interested in me.
Okay.
The experiment that I had on the Columbia shuttle was a test case for growing nematodes on chemically pure media, no bacteria or anything in the media, and we were going to use these it's food, essentially. We're trying to figure out how to grow them in space long term. And the objective was to study muscle atrophy over multiple generations, because worms will go through multiple generations on the space station or in space in microgravity. And so this experiment was put on at the very last minute. There was a lot of testing of the paperwork in order to try and get this experiment on. And then, of course, the tragic accident meant that we didn't get the hardware back right away. But when we did finally, when the canisters were finally recovered, we were able to open them and discover that some of the worms inside were still alive. And in that case, they were alive on both the chemical food and the bacteria food. And so we, there have been follow-on experiments on both the space station and other flights where the worms have been using that new chemical food. So we did have a heritage out of that. A legacy from that tragedy was that we have this system for growing worms in space. Of course, during the accident, it was not dissimilar to, analogous to a meteorite reentry event. And the fact that animals, small animals, but still animals, could survive that reentry event sort of illuminated something that we hadn't previously tested very much, which was whether the possibility of transferring life from Earth to Mars or Mars to Earth via meteorites might be feasible. And in this case, we were actually able to demonstrate, unfortunately and without any intention, of course, that animals can actually withstand a reentry event, and bacteria also, because there were bacteria in the plants that the worms were eating.
Take us through what happened. So we can use Mars Science Lab and Curiosity as an example, because which is actually how I came across you, and I heard you on a radio driving down to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And so what is the process? How do they sterilize everything? Where does it start? Does it start with the payload manufacturer? Does it start at integration? How does all of this come together, and what is the role of your office?
Sure. So we've been talking about Mars, and I'll actually take Viking as an example and then compare it to the Mars Science Laboratory, because
okay.
Viking is the mission. Is that okay? Viking is the mission where we did everything the most stringently. And since Viking, we actually haven't done all of the precautions. We relaxed them because we learned more about Mars. So for planetary protection, the idea is that you protect the location only to the extent that you think there's a chance of contaminating with Earth life, or you think there's a chance of life coming back. So for the moon, we don't actually protect anymore because we're confident there is no Earth potential for Earth life to grow. On Mars, we think there might be, and during the Vikings, we were even more uncertain as to whether Earth life could survive. So the Viking spacecraft, during the design of those spacecraft, they designed them so that they could be baked just before getting sent to Mars. And so during the whole process of assembling them, all of the pieces of hardware that came in as they were being built were being cleaned, wiped down with alcohol, and just making sure that there were very few organisms on the surfaces of those spacecraft parts. Then as they were getting assembled, we kept doing assays to check how many organisms were there, kept cleaning the spacecraft, and after everything was put together, there are pictures, I don't know if you remember seeing, but there's a picture of the Viking back shell and heat shield all packaged up inside a big steel chamber. That's actually an oven. And the Viking spacecraft were the landers in their heat shield and back shell. Each of them was baked for several days at over a boiling point of water in order to kill any residual organisms that might be present on the spacecraft. And then they were put into the cruise stage in the orbiter and put on top of the rocket and launched to Mars. So that way, we had confidence. The cleaning process and the assays showed that there were a few hundred of these heat-resistant spores, the bacillus spores that live on the outside of the space station, fewer than 300 of those per square meter of spacecraft surface. That's bigger than a square yard. And then after the baking process, there were 10,000 of them less, so four orders of magnitude less, which means there was 0.03 of a spore. And you can't really have 0.03 of a spore, so statistically, but in fact they were supposed to be all dead on each square meter of spacecraft surface. And if you do the averages, that means there were only 30 spores remaining on all of the surfaces of the Viking landers that were when they were launched to Mars.
Okay, so but you take it out of the oven and you have to put it on the rocket and at the pad and all of that. So doesn't it pick up Earth microbes and contamination just in that process alone?
It's all packaged up in its heat shield and back shell, so only the outside of the heat shield and the back shell get exposed. the heat shield part will, of course, get very hot as it goes through the Mars atmosphere. The back shell doesn't get quite so hot, but it does kill off some small number of spores. So there were a small number of spores present in the Viking landers, but many fewer than on any subsequent spacecraft, because on subsequent spacecraft, we eliminated that final baking step based on what we found out from the Vikings about the surface of Mars. It's cold, it's very dry, it's got a lot of ultraviolet light. It's a pretty hostile environment. It was decided in the international community that we didn't have to do that final baking step, so the Pathfinders didn't have it, and none of the subsequent spacecraft.
So there's no perfection here. You have a low level of tolerance from your process that you go with.
And that actually derives from the history of planetary protection, where initially it was decided there should be a probability of contamination. And you have a total probability of contaminating Mars through all of human exploration when we're interested in understanding life on Mars before we contaminated it ourselves, of 1 in 1,000. And that was divided up. So the Soviet Union and the United States got 1.4 × 10⁻⁴, or something like this, and then the rest of the world, the European Space Agency didn't exist, got the remaining fractions. So it was 0.8 and 0.2 or something. I don't remember how the numbers actually work out. And so then the United States divided that total probability of contamination that we were allowed to do, so that some part of it went to the first Viking, part of it went to the second Viking. And based on that probability of contaminating Mars, which of course is a number that you can estimate however you feel like, it was determined that they needed to have this fewer than 30 spores on the surfaces of the Viking landers. And that was based on understanding how likely it was that the spacecraft would get there, how likely it was that the Earth organisms might grow once they got there, based on the limited understanding of Earth organisms. And so at that time, we did this, the Viking project did this whole probabilistic calculation. Since then, for Mars only, we've just accepted the Viking numbers, which means that Mars actually gets off easy relative to somewhere like Europa, where there's an ocean underneath the surface.
That's what I was going to ask you. So the standards would be different if you're going to a near-Earth object or Venus or Europa.
Exactly. So for a near-Earth object, where it's crossing the orbit of the Earth all the time, it's probably going to be a very small airless asteroid of some sort, very unlikely that Earth life can survive. Those objects actually have no restrictions on the number of organisms that you bring there. Just the spacecraft have to be assembled in a cleanroom facility, which is what happens to them anyway. The same kind of requirement applies to Venus, because the surface of Venus is, you know, melts lead and is bathed in boiling sulfuric acid. And so those locations where Earth life cannot survive have no restrictions on the amount of Earth life that you're allowed to bring. Of course, your spacecraft has to be assembled in spacecraft facilities, so it's pretty clean. The only restrictions that we put on Earth life going to other locations are when you go to places where we think Earth life could survive, and currently there are three of those. There's Mars, there's Enceladus, and there's Europa. And some of the other moons in the outer solar system, like Triton, as we learn more about them, we might be more concerned. But the three places where we know we have concerns are Enceladus, Europa, and Mars. Mars, as I mentioned, has these at-launch requirements because we've gone there a lot, and so we have a better understanding of what we think is necessary to do when going to that location. For either Europa or Enceladus, we have a requirement that there should be a 1 × 10⁻⁴ probability of introducing a viable organism into liquid water, which means it has to get underneath the surface of Europa down to the ocean, which may be fairly easy if those cycloidal cracks open and close on the period of weeks. And if you're going to Enceladus, of course, we think there's warm ice or water near the South Pole. And so any mission that might go near the South Pole might have a greater than 10⁻⁴ probability of going, or chance of going, near the South Pole, would then have to meet these requirements of having essentially no viable organisms present. And in order to do that, you can take into account both your pre-launch baking, cleaning and baking steps, or whatever other sterilization modality, microbial reduction modality is what we call it, because sterilization is in the eye of the beholder. And then also you get to take into account whatever conditions you experience after launch, which at Jupiter, where Europa is located, would certainly include the radiation environment.
So we've got New Horizons on this long trip out to Pluto. Was there any sterilization or treatment for that?
New Horizons is considered to be a Category 2 mission. That's the kind where we know it's going to go near places that we're worried about, but it require any kind of reduction in cleanliness, just regular spacecraft assembly room, clean room procedures. And that is on the basis of it being a flyby mission of, you know, flew by quite a number of things, Jupiter system. And, of course, it's, as it keeps going out, it will eventually fly by Europa, fly by Pluto and Charon and all the rest of the moons in the Pluto system. But it currently has a lower than 10 to the minus 4th probability of impacting any of those objects. And given that, then we don't have to worry about whether those objects have liquid water on them, which would be what we would be concerned about, warm ice or liquid water.
Okay, so fast forward us to Mars Science Lab and Curiosity, and why was there such a fuss that people started talking about saying that it bypassed sterilization and will contaminate Mars?
So the that gets to an aspect of Mars which is more complicated because we have a better understanding of Mars. It turns out that most of the surface of Mars is cold and dry, like the Vikings measured and like the places where the Pathfinder mission and the Mars exploration rovers went to. There are certain places on Mars, predominantly in the bands sort of in the middle latitude, so between 25 and 55 degrees north and south, around 45 degrees, sort of halfway up, where we see indications that there may be liquid flowing, and that's probably salty water, so it's the hypothesis as to what that liquid might be. But in the international community, in the international rules about planetary protection guidelines, there is a concern that these regions might be more hospitable to Earth life than this very dry, dusty region at the equator. And so initially, the Mars Science Laboratory had the possibility of landing anywhere between 60 degrees north and south on Mars. And so that meant it was potentially hoping to land in one of these regions, locations where there might be the potential for liquid water, and certainly the potential for ice to be near the surface of Mars. And it turns out, of course, the Curiosity rover is carrying a heat source because it's got a plutonium power source, a radiothermal generator to produce power. That's why it doesn't have solar panels on it, just because it's got its own little nuclear power plant. And that means that the plutonium, if it crashes and breaks open, plutonium is hot. That's the aspect of it. One of the aspects of it being radioactive is that it gets warm. It's actually, you know, quite hot. You couldn't hold one in your hands because it's so hot. It would burn you from heat as well as from radiation. So the plutonium sources meant that we didn't want the Mars Science Laboratory to land near ice unless they went through the full Viking-level baking process. And the mission designers thought that that would be too much of a challenge for them, so they didn't want to bake the spacecraft. So instead they said, okay, we'll avoid places where there might be ice when you land. But, of course, they were hoping that they might be able to drill into ice. And so in that case, just the drill bits were supposed to have been treated at this full Viking-level sterilization, which would permit them then to touch ice. Or water, whatever you might find, where there is a better chance that Earth life might be able to survive, because, of course, Earth life needs water. With the Gale crater landing site having been selected, that's right on the equator. So there's no expectation from all the data that we have on Mars so far that there will ever be a chance of touching ice or finding ice or water at the Gale crater site, which means that all of these special additional precautions that you have to take to touch ice, to go to special regions is what they're called, weren't necessary for the Mars Science Laboratory. But there was a bit of a gap in the timing of when this was realized. So during the whole process of assembly of the Mars Science Lab, they did a wonderful job keeping the spacecraft clean. That spacecraft has, you know, fewer than 30 spores per square meter. They're 10 times less than Viking. They're very clean in terms of the general spacecraft cleanliness. The entire surface area of that spacecraft is bigger than a football field, and it has fewer spores on it, fewer of these heat-resistant organisms than you would find in a teaspoon of water or on the surface of your hand. So the spacecraft is very clean from the general cleanliness perspective, so from the average Mars perspective. However, the drill bits did not get baked and then protected from recontamination the way that they would have had to be in order to touch ice. That was a decision that was based on multiple factors, having to do with the risk posture of the mission, and they wanted to have a bit in the drill itself rather than so that they didn't have to open up the box and grab a drill bit after they got to Mars. A lot of reasons why they wanted to do that. It makes perfect sense, but they didn't tell me they were doing that until after they'd already done it. So their paperwork wasn't in order. And that's really what the problem was, and we fixed all the paperwork before launch. So they were completely compliant with the landing site that they wanted to go to. It's just that that landing site, fortunately, didn't have ice or water near it where they would be unable to touch the ice because they didn't have a clean enough drill bit.
So this was really an administrative issue?
Yeah, I mean, their paperwork was late, so my paperwork was late, so my counterparts and other planetary protection officers around the world, you know, heard about this and they all know about it, but it would have been nice to have everything done in a more timely manner. So it's more of a project management kind of lesson learned, where you have to make sure that all the requirements are understood and all the paperwork is done properly, and people don't accidentally forget about something and then realize later on, oops, we were supposed to do that. But it was not a problem with any kind of the mission was fully compliant with the requirements that they had when they finally launched.
I'm sure you know the cost component of planetary protection applications to a mission like, say, Curiosity in Mars Science Lab. If the probability of risk of contamination is really minimum to begin with, how do you determine that it's worth paying the extra cost to go through all of these steps that you've been talking about? And I'm also assuming that it adds time to when you can do your mission. You have to allow for all of these different steps and applications and processes. I'm thinking in terms of the cost-benefit analysis of paying all this extra money to go through this if the chances of risk are really low to begin with.
Yeah, well, first of all, all this extra money, the cost of the people and the extra assays done and everything on for planetary protection on MSL was significantly less than 1% of that mission cost. It was maybe a couple of tens of millions of dollars. And that's a generous estimate. So there is a sort of perception amongst the engineering community that planetary protection is overly expensive, and so they use it as a kind of an excuse for not doing things carefully. But in the Viking mission, there's the number that people throw out, but in fact, it's impossible to tell for the Vikings how much did planetary protection cost, because it was integrated into the whole process of systems and engineering and spacecraft design from the very beginning. It's like asking, oh, well, quality control is so expensive. Validation and verification, we can't do that. It's too expensive. It's just another aspect of what the mission has to comply with. So, you'll also notice that Vikings were built at Marshall and the rest of the spacecraft are being built at JPL. So there's a little bit of intra-NASA competition going on here. JPL also built the Rangers, which were baked and did not work early on, but that may have been due to all kinds of other things than just the baking step. So the integration of planetary protection into mission design is something that it has a benefit and also a risk, because it does make a different kind of mission engineering approach than what JPL engineers are used to doing so far. It is something that the Europa concept studies have signed up to do, because the Europa mission will have to be baked or have some sterilization process similar to what went on with the Vikings. We did it on Viking, and it worked perfectly well. So it is possible to do. Viking engineers also freely admitted that the fact that they had to go through all these extra testing conditions in order to be able to be confident that the baking step would work actually meant that they ended up with a much better spacecraft, because they tested it better. And that testing does perhaps add some small additional estimate to the cost, but it's not nearly as much as people will argue if they don't want to do it in the first place.
Does it add a lot of time to mission development and planning?
It doesn't have to. If you design it into the beginning of the mission, one of the things that happened in the history of sort of the JPL culture about planetary protection is that they didn't think of planetary protection when they were initially designing the Pathfinder rover. And even the MERs didn't have a very good understanding of what they might need to do. So they didn't, in their systems engineering, design the spacecraft to be cleanable easily. And so then when you had to bring planetary protection in in the ATLO process after they'd done all the design, of course it was difficult to do, because they hadn't designed it in order to be accommodating that. So it was a bit of a, you know, that you got the egg after the chicken, or so the chicken after the egg, in the wrong, yeah, the cart before the horse is probably a better analogy, or metaphor, because they had already done all the design without thinking about it. And then, of course, if you suddenly impose an additional set of requirements after you've already got your spacecraft all designed, that becomes expensive. But it wasn't the fact of planetary protection, it was the fact that they hadn't done it early enough that caused the additional potential for cost and delay. The timing point comes in when you're trying to do the assays, because to measure the fire burn on the spacecraft, to measure the number of heat-resistant spores on the spacecraft surfaces, the better process is to let them grow for 3 days. But we now have tests that will give you an answer in half an hour. So so those timing issues, they're manageable during ANTLO because all our missions have managed them, but we now have ways of making things much shorter than they would be. You don't have to wait for those 3 days if you're worried about having something too dirty.
Your first email question of the day is going to come in from Todd in San Diego.
Okay.
And he said, a few minutes ago, several times you've mentioned the international community one way or another. What is the enforcement? If this is an ESA project, are they doing exactly what you're doing, or are the Russians and Chinese doing this too? Is there any enforcement?
Well, mostly the enforcement is done by peer pressure, but that's a very good question. And I will, so the activity of planetary protection actually comes directly from the Outer Space Treaty. Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty says that states party to the treaty, that is all spacefaring nations, shall explore other locations so as to avoid their harmful contamination and to avoid adverse effects on the environment of the Earth from the introduction of extraterrestrial matter. So that's the Outer Space Treaty. So all 100 plus countries that have signed the Outer Space Treaty have agreed to do this. The way that we develop guidelines for how to do that has to do with the International Council for Science, which advises the United Nations on scientific issues. That organization, the International Council for Science, has a committee on space research that advises the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, which is the body that works with the Outer Space Treaty. So the Committee on Space Research of the International Council for Science advises the UN Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space on how to go about implementing that treaty for scientific purposes. And the Committee on Space Research has a standing panel on planetary protection that sort of maintains the international guidelines for planetary protection. And every 2 years when the Committee on Space Research has their biennial council colloquium, I've forgotten what the name of the thing is, assembly, it's called an assembly, the panel on planetary protection meets and discusses the guidelines for planetary protection. Those were initiated in the, really going back to the 60s, at the signing of the Outer Space Treaty, and even before to previous organizations worried about contaminating other locations where we might want to look for life. But those guidelines now are quite well established in the international community. And on the basis of the Committee on Space Research Policy, space agencies then develop their own guidelines. And all space agencies, certainly NASA, ESA, and Roscosmos, agree that they will not participate in any international missions unless COSPAR guidelines are met, which means that we're not forcing, India to use NASA guidelines, but everybody agrees to follow those COSPAR guidelines. So when there's an Indian mission, or when there's a Roscosmos mission, or when there's a European Space Agency mission, all of the contributing instruments to that mission, all of the contributing agencies agree to follow COSPAR guidelines. And between ESA and NASA, we actually have formal agreements on planetary protection, so my counterpart at ESA and I coordinate at the level of wording the requirements that we have for different missions. So I see his documents and he sees my documents.
And China does this too in Japan? In Brazil?
Japan certainly does. The Hayabusa mission, actually, when they did a sample return mission, they were working closely with NASA because they were also using NASA assets. And I just last week had an email from the Japanese Space Agency, JAXA, interested in setting up their own planetary protection officer as a more visible position within that agency. China, when they were contributing a satellite to Roscosmos for the Phobos-Skunt mission, Roscosmos was the responsible for that mission, because as the launching agency and the country to which the launching agency belongs are responsible under the Outer Space Treaty for compliance with COSPAR guidelines, are responsible for compliance with the treaty, which means they have to ensure that they follow COSPAR guidelines. And, because of the unfortunate relationship of NASA and the United States with China and the Chinese Space Agency, I was not privy to any of those discussions, but my European counterpart, I expect, was hearing some of those things. And so, although I didn't see it, because ESA has the same requirements as NASA does, that all missions we participate in follow COSPAR guidelines, we did see the Russian documentation showing that their orbital lifetime and everything, all of the approaches that they were intending to use to avoid impact into Mars of that mission were adequate based on our review.
Another real quick email is Carl in Albuquerque, and he says, if all you're doing is launching a telecommunication satellite or a satellite array or even some of these CubeSats that we hear so much about, are there any planetary protection requirements for just launching a satellite?
If you're launching a satellite to Earth orbit, no. because if you're sending Earth life to Earth, we don't actually worry about that. If you are wanting to launch a communication satellite to Mars orbit, for satellites orbiting Mars, we allow two different options. One is that they can meet the cleanliness standards, and in order to do that, they can actually take into account the ability, the fact that they're going to be entering the Mars atmosphere, so they can do modeling of the burn-up and break-up of the satellite in the Mars atmosphere, which is something that people do around Earth for satellites and in the concerns about orbital debris. The other option at Mars is that you can stay up for a long time, and currently, in its surprising optimism, we have a requirement that you only have to stay up for 50 years, because that was considered at the time that this agreement was first made, that that would be the length of time after which we'd have done all the possible experiments to look for life on Mars, and we would be done, and, you know, then we'd go and mess it up with Earth life. So the 50-year requirement is a requirement for staying in orbit around Mars. Any satellite that stays up for 50 years, of course, hasn't considered the fact that they're going to burn up in the atmosphere. And although that doesn't kill everything, it does kill a lot of things. And so even a satellite that is supposed to stay up rather than be clean is clean to the level of a regular spacecraft assembly clean room. And so it probably will have its organisms killed off at the point that it does reenter.
We have a caller on hold, but I'll do this one other quick question, which is Alex is in Denver, Colorado. And he says, I'm really curious, years ago, before Elon Musk actually started SpaceX, he had the idea to somehow get a launch to go to Mars on what he called the Mars Oasis Project, which was to send a greenhouse to Mars chock full of Earth life and vegetation to have it grow on Mars in order to get ready for someday a Martian settlement. Would something like that, even if it had been in a greenhouse, ever be permitted? And would there be an enforcement to stop a private party from doing that? I would assume when Elon was talking about that, he wasn't probably up on any planetary protection requirements, especially since he couldn't even find a ride to go to Mars.
So there's a couple of ways that that has the potential to be regulated. First, of course, as I mentioned, the Outer Space Treaty says that you have to do planetary protection. The Outer Space Treaty also says that any activity of a non-governmental organization is the responsibility of the government. So a U.S. entity that wants to launch to Mars that is not part of NASA still has to follow all the rules, because otherwise the United States is in violation of the Outer Space Treaty. That's something we can talk about a little bit later, because the U.S. doesn't really have any laws to regulate that other than the Outer Space Treaty. In addition, the concern for sending some kind of satellite to somewhere like Mars, you may be able to get your rocket, but you still need all the communications capabilities to talk to the satellite as it's on the way. And in that case, you probably are going to want to use the Deep Space Network, and that's a NASA element. And so that means that anybody who wants to use the Deep Space Network still has to comply with NASA's policy that any organization we work with follows Coast Guard policy.
So my way or the highway, right?
Well, we're saying follow the international guidelines or we're not going to help you. Because if NASA did help an organization that was not following the international guidelines, that would put the United States in violation of the Outer Space Treaty, and we don't want to do that.
If I ever get a chance to talk to Elon again, I might ask him if he actually considered planetary protection requirements for his Mars Oasis idea. I mean, that's long gone history, but it might be fun to ask him.
Well, Chris McKay and I actually have had this conversation, and because my background is in plant biology, I actually have something to say about that. It turns out it is possible to grow plants with no bacteria. You can make a perfectly sterile plant that has only plant cells and no bacterial cells, and if you put that plant in a greenhouse and launch it to Mars, there's no chance that there's any bacteria that are going to get out and colonize Mars, contaminate Mars, and the plant is certainly not going to contaminate Mars, because there's no way it would survive if it tried to get out. It's going to get frozen. Or desiccated. So, in fact, a greenhouse that had only plant cells and no microbial cells would be permitted by current planetary protection guidelines to launch to Mars. You just have to show that it had no microbes along.
Well, you know, when Chris is back on the show, I'll ask him about that, too. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, eventually we want to send humans to Mars. When we do that, does it sort of undo all the planetary protection stuff that we've done before?
Well, the purpose of planetary protection is to facilitate the study of life on Mars. And so presumably by the time the international community agrees that it's okay to contaminate Mars with Earth life, we will have already accomplished those scientific goals.
Okay, that makes sense. I think maybe the question about launching satellites is maybe any concern for microbial life of extraterrestrial sources contaminating spacecraft in space, and then if it deorbits, it could introduce it to Earth. Is that considered?
Well, we have no evidence for extraterrestrial life, and we certainly have, it's hard to have less than no evidence, but we have no evidence that there might be life floating around in particles in space that might cause, stick to satellites and cause harm to the Earth when they came back, as distinct from particles that are floating around in space and just are coming to Earth normally, which is a fairly, actually turns out for really small interstellar dust particles, is a fairly mild entry event. So the sort of the V'ger Andromeda strain concept, of the original Andromeda strain was a mutated Earth organism that then came back to Earth and caused harm. That's something that Planetary Protection actually does not regulate. We don't require astronauts on the space station to be tested to see whether they've got mutated diseases that might come back and infect other people. It's much more likely that they'd actually have a problem from newly mutated diseases on Earth that then subsequently infect the astronauts. So the thing about life in space, floating around in space, is that, you know, viruses and stuff, you know, this idea of viruses from Venus, or the, you know, the Fred Hoyle reminiscing idea of, you know, panspermia causing infectious events on Earth, is that viruses tend to evolve, or disease organisms, parasites, tend to evolve in a fairly close relationship with their host. And if they've been looking for humans in space, they've been looking rather an awfully long time.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So does that make it really not likely, not probable, that if there are bacteria on Mars, that they would be able to infect humans when they go there?
It's more likely, the concern is not so much that there would be a disease that is specifically designed to infect humans, it's that there might be some organism on Mars that would find conditions on Earth much more pleasant. It's more of a rabbits in Australia scenario than it is a bubonic plague scenario, where you get organisms that are just, they think Antarctica is this lovely, warm, wonderful holiday venue, and they overgrow it with all kinds of red, orange bugs that change the albedo and cause it to melt even faster than it's already melting, or some similar sort of, it's more likely to be some sort of an environmental impact rather than an organism that would be specifically focused on causing disease in humans. But the problem is we don't know. And in an effort to acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know, the Planetary Protection considerations tend to be more conservative. They take more precautions early on until we have some information, and then you relax them, as we've done with Mars. You relax them as you learn more and you feel more comfortable that you actually understand enough to be able to say, yes, that's okay, but this still is not.
Interesting. Okay. That's all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Cassie, is it more likely that if there was bacteria or something on Mars and it came back to Earth, that it would be damaging to Earth life? Or could it be like stuff out of the rainforest that we can use for cures for Earth problems or human problems on Earth or illnesses?
I have absolutely no idea. That's the problem with not knowing anything. I would imagine that either of those, or perhaps both of those, might be true in different cases. We just don't know anything about life on that might be on Mars, other than the Earth life that we've already put there.
We're halfway through the program, so let's pause and we'll take our first break. And listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. Your phone calls are welcome. 1-866-687-7223. When we get back, I want to ask her about all these private missions we hear about, like Mars One out of Holland, wanting to send humans to Mars in 2021. I'm willing to bet they've never considered planetary protection. It's probably not even in their consciousness. But there are other missions around, too, that are talking about this. So we'll ask our guest about that. Again, back in 3 minutes, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Monday Space Show. We're talking planetary protection with Dr. Catherine Conley, who is the NASA Planetary Protection Officer. Doctor, during the break, we talked about that your office is a best-kept secret because, you know, this is an incredibly interesting and informative program, but we don't hear about this subject or certainly in the detail that you're able to share with us today. And as I said, I'm 11-plus years and nearly 2,000 interviews. So you're a closely held secret, but you don't want to be, right?
Yeah, certainly it's important for people to understand that we do planetary protection, both from the standpoint of being sort of ecologically responsible, conservation-minded and all that good stuff, but also because it's actually beneficial to the exploration of space. If you want to send astronauts to Mars, for example, you really should make sure that there's nothing hazardous there that might, you know, harm them on the way. Even if you want to send them on a one-way trip, it would be nice if they actually survived a reasonably long time. The concern for planetary protection and the reason we are such a well-kept secret, unfortunately, is that there just aren't very many of us practicing the work. It's something where you don't get a degree in planetary protection. It's a rather complicated area to learn about, but certainly people who have degrees in engineering or in biology, or you know, my counterpart at Europe is a physicist, the need is that you have people who can actually translate between different aspects of what's going on. So you need somebody who can talk to a lawyer or a politician or a engineer or a scientist and explain what the details of things that are going on, but also then understand the policy issues and the implications for sending humans on commercial space flights to Mars.
Is that changing, and are you getting more educational awareness out into the marketplace, or is it still a closely held secret?
With the increase in interest in astrobiology, which is this sort of crossover between planetary science and biology, there is some level of raised awareness, but I think it's always important. I'm very glad to be on your show for the purposes of letting people know that we do this. I often feel like when I sit on planes, I'm doing education and outreach because I talk to the people sitting next to me. But it's a it's just something that, as an office of one, and then a few contractor and support staff, I don't have the chance to do this as much as I would like to. So thanks very much for asking me to be on the show.
Well, thank you for giving us your time. Listeners, again, our phone line, if you want to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. So before the break, I mentioned Mars One, which is a private group out of Holland that says they're going to send people to Mars by 2021. But there are other private groups where they're just completely bypassing a government or a public space program, and on the assumption that somebody may be able to pull this off in the relatively near future, they're supposed to comply with all of this too, but their countries would have to enforce it on them through the OST, right?
Well, that is one aspect of it. Certainly, any country signatory to the Outer Space Treaty is supposed to maintain the Outer Space Treaty, including Article 9 that mandates planetary protection. In addition, fortunately for that is that the fortunate aspect of that is that about 10 years ago, looking in preparation for a previous round of sort of exploration and human exploration of the solar system, at the level of the Committee on Space Research, we did in fact put in place guidelines or developed guidelines for human exploration of Mars. And in 2008, those were adopted into the formal COSPAR policy. So there are guidelines as to what an organization would need to do. And in fact, it's recognized that although the objectives of planetary protection don't change when humans are involved, certainly the way that you implement it will have to be, because you can't put a human in an oven and bake them for 4 days and then have them do anything useful afterwards, except maybe smell. So the concern is that when you're sending humans, you have to make sure that the places that the humans go are places on Mars where Earth life is unlikely to survive, and then that you don't leave behind your little doggy bags and things, implement leave no trace correctly and pack out everything you packed in and don't leave, you know, as we did for the Apollo program, little bags of waste products that are sitting there and potentially going to be slowly degrading over time and releasing organisms when they go down to the Antarctic and go and study the areas, you know, the places where the Scott expedition went and the various expeditions that were trying to explore the Antarctic, and you pull out this little chunk of donkey dung and you try to culture organisms out of it. It turns out they're still there and growing and perfectly able to come alive again if you give them hospital conditions. So those kinds of things are the kind of things that we would expect an exploration of Mars would not do. They would be expected to package up their waste products and ensure that they didn't get out. And you know, if you go on a one-way trip, even then you should try to engineer your living conditions, living spaces, your habitats, and also in particular land in a place where we don't think it's likely that Earth life would be able to propagate, to grow and reproduce anytime soon. That would be at the equator, where it's cold, you know, it gets fairly warm, but because it gets warm, it is extremely dry. And so any organisms that might be sitting on the surface on the spacecraft or a habitat aren't going to go anywhere. There's no liquid that might transport them.
So if somebody did a one-way Mars mission or went to Mars and was settling and somebody dies, would they be able to bury the body on Mars, or would they have to freeze it somehow to return it, or what would happen there? I mean, that's going
to I wouldn't be able to. At this point, we don't have any expectation that would be happening, and so I would be uncomfortable with somebody burying a body rather than keeping it above ground somehow, as they do, you know, in places like New Orleans, where they have a different reason for not putting things underground. It's too wet as opposed to being too dry. However, for these missions, these putative commercial missions to Mars, unless they have a purely commercial communication system, they still will have to interact with the communications capabilities that are at Mars and in process and at Earth in order to talk to Mars, that are under the aegis of the national space agencies. And in that case, any organization wanting to use those assets would need to comply with the policy of the national of the space agency that is responsible for those assets.
So here's John in Seattle sent in this. He said, a few minutes ago you mentioned that humans would go places on Mars that were dry and not likely to be subject to human contamination. We've always been under the impression that if one could do a humans to Mars mission, they could go any place on Mars that they were capable of. Are you telling us that likely the human zones on Mars would be limited or restricted?
That is within the current Coast Guard guidelines, that humans would not go to locations on Mars that a robot would have to be sterilized in order to go to. It's the same problem with the MSL drill bits versus the Viking spacecraft. If you're going to a place where there's flowing liquid, that would provide a much increased chance that you might transport Earth organisms to somewhere that they could grow, and therefore that would be that is currently in the Coast Guard guidelines prohibited.
A settlement on the moon would probably have a lot more leeway than trying to do a settlement on Mars, correct?
A settlement on the moon has absolutely no restrictions regarding biology, yes.
No restrictions at all?
The requirements for the moon, for any spacecraft or mission going to the moon, are that they provide documentation of where they left their hardware, which sometimes makes some of the military people a little bit uncomfortable. But the point there is that in order to protect the capability to do future science, we want to know where the hardware is so somebody coming across it later doesn't get confused by something. But for the moon, because there is no chance that Earth life would survive there, there is no restriction on transporting Earth life. And as I mentioned, there are those little pack-it-out bags underneath the Apollo spacecraft that are still sitting on the moon from when we sent Apollo astronauts there.
Beth is in Portland, Oregon. This is a far-out question for you. Assuming that at some point we do have some sort of settlement on Mars and people are actually living there to try to establish a settlement, perhaps they've been able to take a pet with them from Earth. Are there any guidelines that are so forward in their thinking or vision that they might apply to someone bringing a dog or a cat to Mars?
Well, so the way that planetary protection, that's actually a very good question. The way that planetary protection works is that we take into account current scientific advice as we go forward with the next round of requirements for any particular mission that might be going forward. So in the event of a colony on Mars that's actually established and wanting to persist over time, I would expect that, as I mentioned to the previous caller, that the questions that we were interested in studying about Mars life have already been answered or have been decided that it's a sufficiently greater benefit to put humans there and potentially contaminate Mars with Earth life than it would be to understand the potential for Mars to have life of its own. So in that case, in these later missions, I would expect that planetary protection requirements are very changed from what they are today, and I would expect them to be much less stringent. If you take Carl Sagan's approach and we do find Mars life, then, of course, there wouldn't be human colonies on Mars at all.
He wasn't supportive of that at all, was he?
He felt that Mars should be left to the Martians. If we find them, they should be left alone. But that is a perspective that different people will have other perspectives, and it's up to the. It's important to have the appropriate level of discussion within the international community to make sure that there is a consensus about what we should do before we do it, as opposed to somebody, you know, releasing Earth life on Mars the way somebody released starlings in Central Park, and now we have starlings everywhere in the United States, and a lot of people don't really like them.
It'd be interesting to see how they took a pet to Mars, since the pet can't really consent. I don't know. It's just...
Informed consent would be a totally different question.
What about... now I'm having a senior moment, and I was going to ask you... hopefully it'll come back to me. So let me do Joe's question, and Joe is over in Las Vegas. And he says, do you see any conflicts down the road if and when we're able to be on Mars and start terraforming?
I would expect, based on how we implement, the process of planetary protection is that we take into account current scientific advice and the current priorities of the scientific and other communities. So over time, as we learn more about Mars, I would expect that a lot of those questions have been worked out already, and so I can't really speak, having no information about what the intervening information was that was gained. But if in a condition where you have people on Mars and you're planning to terraform Mars, I would expect that we know enough about Mars that we've decided that that's an appropriate thing to do and go ahead and do it.
So by the time we were capable of doing that, most of the questions were centering around that, and should it be done would have already been answered.
Yeah, and that's something that we have to – that's a question that we have to answer on Earth. By the time you get people to Mars, you've already done enough potentially that you're going to be running into problems. But the priorities, currently, at least in the international community that's interested in studying Mars and studying life in the universe, the concern is that we have a potential to look at life on Mars, and if we put Earth life there before we have a chance to study it, then we know we have messed it up. We've done that in many conditions, many situations on Earth, where we put Earth life, we rabbits in Australia, kudzu in the United States, all of these invasive species problems where we didn't think about what we were doing before we did it, letting that ship land in Venice that brought the bubonic plague to Europe. The intention behind planetary protection constraints are that we should do things in a thoughtful and well-understood manner. And so the explicit constraint is that you don't do something until you understand the consequences. If you don't understand the consequences, take appropriate precautions, not excessive precautions, but appropriate precautions given the risk-benefit analysis, these cost-benefit estimates that you were addressing earlier, and so that you have you maintain the capabilities, you preserve the opportunity to study things that you want to study as you send intermediate missions, and then as you learn more, and you understand better what you might have there to study and what might not be there. And so as you go forward, I would expect that the development of information over time, the gaining of knowledge, will probably make a lot of this stuff completely obvious because we'll know more and we'll understand what the problems are a lot better than we do now.
Helen is in Phoenix, and she sent in this email and said, David, I'm still at work. I wish I could call in. But it seems plausible that within the next year or two, Bigelow might be able to deploy his private space stations or habitats in low Earth orbit. If he wanted to use one of his space stations as a sample return item or to put a lab in space, would that be entirely under his jurisdiction if this were completely private supported by users around the world? Or would there be issues that the guidelines would come into play given he's in LEO, and maybe alter or severely restrict or influence how he might use one of his habitats as a lab?
Well, so that as a lab to study returned Mars samples, we have requirements about releasing unsterilized Mars material into the environment of the Earth. And given that an orbiting laboratory has an undefined endpoint at which it will reenter the atmosphere and come back down to Earth, that requirement probably would not be adequately met by an orbiting laboratory.
So he has the same problem the ISS has that you talked about earlier.
Any time you put something in orbit, it will eventually fall down. That's the policy, the requirements level aspect of it. A much more important and relevant aspect is the fact that it's going to cost a heck of a lot more to contain things in orbit, just to develop the technologies. Just to build a microscope to go on the International Space Station, we had to pay Zeiss, I don't know how much, money to recalibrate all the gears so that when you turned the knobs on the space station, the microscope moved up and down properly because it's designed for one gravity and there isn't any up there. I happen to know this because I got that microscope in my laboratory at Ames after we decided not to spend it to the space station. But the point is that the intricacies of designing things to function in microgravity would make designing any kind of tools to go on an orbiting station so much more expensive that it really would be cost prohibitive relative to just bringing the samples back to Earth, so where we know how to do the containment.
So for Helen, just because it's a private business venture doesn't exempt him from the cost involved or the rules and the regulations?
If I could do anything I wanted to at infinite cost as a private individual, believe me, I wouldn't be working for NASA.
Fascinating subject. Is any of this taught in graduate courses? If students are listening and they wanted to at least have a survey level of knowledge from a graduate course on planetary protection, would it be in biology or astrobiology?
I am not aware of any focused courses. I have certainly gone and given lectures to various courses in astrobiology, and I think one in a planetary science course. So I am happy to give lectures as that can be arranged. As I said, we just don't have very many people. There are at least four or five other people I can think of who would be capable of providing a lecture. And any of them I would expect would be happy to do it. But yes, you're right. This is an area where it would be really nice to have more people who can give lectures. And certainly, I'm happy to try and steer people in the direction of appropriate information. The planetaryprotection.nasa.gov website, planetary protection is all one word in that address, is certainly an area a place to go to get initial information. And I believe that has my correct address, email address. But certainly contacting me, I would be happy to try and put people in touch with useful information. But it's just an area where there's so few of us. We're all busy actually doing the job, and we don't have enough time to teach people about doing the job. But would be a really good thing to do.
Here's a far-reaching question from me. A lot of us always complain that NASA and our space program doesn't have as much support from members of Congress as it should have, and the general public likes space, but the support's nothing like you get with AARP and some of the other really big organizations where they can bombard Congress with a million letters in 2 days or something like that. Do you think if the guidelines and the topics that we're talking about today and the protections that were in place were better understood and almost general knowledge among the public, that it would foster a healthier space program and space awareness level among our population, which might spill over to a healthier congressional view and support of NASA?
I have certainly had people, probably 90%+ of the people that I sit next to on planes and talk to, that's my sort of limited cross-section of the United States public.
That's your polling, right?
Yeah, that would be my polling activity. The vast majority of people are absolutely delighted that there is some organization in the government that is doing this, and they had absolutely no idea it was going on. So as an aspect of sort of responsible exploration, for NASA, I think that people knowing that would be very helpful. Excuse me, that's my cell phone going off in the background, and I don't know where it is, so I guess I'll just try to stand away from the noise. As a civil servant, I'm kind of restricted in how much I can comment, but I certainly encourage people to write to their congressmen if they want to tell them anything.
Interesting. I mean, even the people who give us our news, the anchors or whoever's reading the teleprompter, they're clueless about all of this, too. So it's really frustrating if we see this as a path to better understanding of what we're doing in space and maybe even the complexities and the specialties of our space program. It would just seem to me it'd be a winner all around if more and more people knew what was going on with getting these missions ready, how they're done, that type of thing. Even the private sector is going to have to go through to pay attention to it. I just think it would be a big plus.
I certainly agree with you. I would love to have everybody knowing what we do and how, in general, what NASA does is quite, we put quite a lot of effort into it and try to spend taxpayer dollars effectively, and it would be very nice for the taxpayers to know what we're doing with their money.
Tom sent in an email, and he says, I'm in the L.A. area. I have lots of friends that work for JPL. I do know that there is, quote, friendly competition among the various NASA centers. Friendly is in quotes. He put it there. Do all of the NASA centers participate in this? Do you have different relationships with the different NASA centers, or some more into being compliant and working on this than others, or is there no difference whatsoever?
Well, each NASA center has more or less of an area or several areas of expertise. And certainly JPL is a little bit of an odd case because it is a federally funded research organization that's maintained by Caltech but does a lot of NASA work. So it's only sort of a NASA center. It's kind of got a little bit of an odd position there. But the expertise of JPL is certainly in building planetary exploration probes, amongst other things. So today JPL is the location that has the greatest expertise in doing that. Another center that does a lot of those activities is Goddard Research Center, which is in Maryland, just up the way from where I'm sitting now. And the different centers, the different attitudes towards planetary protection being just one thing, of those centers reflect a lot what kind of history they've had. So Goddard builds large numbers of telescopes for various reasons and has a different type of understanding of things like contamination control and particulate control than an organization like JPL, where they don't build a huge number of telescopes. Because, of course, if you get particles on the surface of the telescope, that's the imaging surface, it really screws up the images. So JPL is by far the center that has the most expertise with building planetary probes. And Mars probes in particular. And so it's difficult to tease out the things that go on today from the things that have gone on in the past. Certainly at Marshall, where they did build the Vikings and they baked them and they did all the testing that was necessary, that was in a different budgetary climate as well as other sorts of climates. And so So everything is rolled up. But it is certainly true that different centers have different attitudes based on their different histories. But there's so much sort of cultural baggage that goes along with that. It's hard to.
There's
not a single thing that you can identify as a point of similarity or difference.
So you're the master of juggling NASA cultural differences.
It is certainly something I have to do. Yeah, as part of the rest of my job. Yeah.
June is in Houston, Texas, and says, David, I'm also at work, but we have a couple of old missions that have left our solar system. Please ask your guest if they went through any planetary protection systems or sterilizations when they were launched, and would that still be effective even though they're not landing on anything and just going out, I guess, into no man's land? Does any of this matter with those missions? I think she's talking about Explorer.
Yeah, well, there's also the Voyagers.
I mean Voyager, yeah. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
And so the Voyager spacecraft, I'm actually not familiar with the whether they were cleaned to any level more stringent than standard clean room procedures. I would suspect not, because they were flyby missions. They certainly were required to comply with the probabilistic impact requirements that we had for avoiding planetary bodies, but that was in the interest of the mission, since they really wanted to fly by them and not hit them. So as things go out into interstellar space, it will take quite a long time for the Voyagers to get anywhere, to get to the next solar system, period. And the possibility of hitting a planet in another solar system without aiming for it, or even with aiming for it, is pretty small. I do not know what specific planetary protection considerations were imposed on the Voyager missions. Certainly they would have had impact requirements and have met them since they got out of the solar system. And after that, the predictions get so chaotic that we don't, you know, it's difficult to model orbits out past about 100 years because things go chaotic. So to impose requirements on a mission that's gone into interstellar space is a bit of not particularly useful.
But I guess there's no indication that they're going to pick up any contamination going through space, correct? I mean, there's nothing out there that would contaminate it, right?
We certainly have no evidence of that to date that I'm aware of, yeah.
So they could just sail on kind of like in a big clean room?
I think it's pretty empty in interstellar space. I don't think there's much of anything there. I'm not an astrophysicist, so I don't have real details. But, yeah, I think they're pretty much just going through.
I don't know. Captain Kirk encountered things out there.
I think Hollywood needed something to make a show about, yeah. Or whatever it was named.
You know,
definitely.
Do you ever hear from members of Congress or their staff? Do they know you're alive? Does anyone ever come in and say, what are you doing, or come testify before Congress or anything like that?
I have not been asked to do that yet. I believe my predecessor may have been asked once. I certainly did interact with the State Department after the Phobos Grunt experience, and so I will be providing the documentation that NASA obtained to confirm that Coast Guard guidelines were being complied with in order to, you know, so the State Department knows that NASA was ensuring U.S. compliance with the Outer Space Treaty. But, again, being such a small office, there are a number of these sort of coordinating activities that don't happen on a level that I would really prefer them to. There is an effort that NASA has done to try and maintain that a little better, because part of the NASA Advisory Council is an advisory committee on planetary protection, and that committee has ex officio representatives from other government agencies to keep them apprised of what we have going on. But I haven't had much interaction with Congress, no.
This is Harold, and Harold is also in Los Angeles, and he said there was, a microbial planetary society experiment on Phobos Grunt that did come back to Earth. Do you have any information on that? Did that have anything to do with your office?
Yes, in fact. Early on in the planning of that activity, I was actually asked to be on their advisory committee. And as I mentioned, the Russian space agency did ensure that the Phobos Grunt mission was going to be, would have, had it gotten to Mars, complied with all of the international requirements on orbital lifetime. So that mission was demonstrated not to be to have a 1% chance of impacting Mars based on the operations that they were intending for that mission, which is the international requirement for impact. So in addition, as I understand it, I didn't hear much about the advisory aspects of being on the Hunter Society's advisory committee for the LIFE experiment. But as I understand it, they did do a number of impact tests and various other testing to try and demonstrate that the capsule would stay closed if it did accidentally impact. And they did, in fact, change, as I understand it, the composition of one of the contents of one of the capsules. They had been anticipating the possibility of sending some very dry, cold desert soil in which we don't know all the organisms. And instead, they switched that, I believe, to a hot desert soil, Gobi Desert, or some other desert where the organisms that might be present would be less likely to be able to survive on a cold, dry place like Mars. Unfortunately for the mission, but making it easier on the minds of planetary protection officers everywhere, that mission did not, tragically did not make it out of Earth orbit.
This may be the last question from the day, and it's Larry is in Billings, Montana, and he says, help me understand that. We know we have meteorite pieces on Earth that come from Mars. Are they devoid of any kind of bacteria or anything because there simply isn't anything on Mars, or is it killed in the millions or however many years it takes to get blown off of Mars and come over and find its way to Earth, or are there some other processes at work?
The main difference in the meteorites from the meteorites that are returned that are coming to Earth naturally and a sample return mission is exactly the time period. Sample return mission will come back in 2 years. It will be collecting surface samples of Mars, not the basalts, which are possibly the mantle material that are found, the composition of all of the Martian meteorites that we have is basalt, which is lava, potentially from the Mars mantle, a very large impact. The sample return mission would be returning surface samples, would be returning probably sedimentary samples, would ideally be returning samples that are collected from places that are likely, we consider to be likely to have Earth life, and Mars life, excuse me, so they're coming back from Mars to Earth. And so the concern is precisely the time period and the composition of the samples that are being returned.
So nothing can hibernate for these hundreds of millions of years that floats around in space. That would do it in if there was something there, or is it just because it's coming from lava?
Well, a couple of things. They are out in space for millions of years, and they are getting exposed to the solar radiation during that time, not protected by ozone layers or magnetic fields or anything. So they're getting the full exposure to the radiation environment, and that would be certainly likely to kill off most Earth organisms. The composition and the source from which they're ejected being so much deeper deeper underneath the crust of Mars is another consideration. One of the aspects that makes it a little difficult to answer the question is, of course, that most of these meteorites have been on Earth for a while, and so when you look in them, you do find life, but you find Earth life, or you find things that might look like life but in fact are not, or you find things that you can't tell at all what they are, as happened with Allen Hill's meteorite, but the most recent meteorite to be returned from Mars, the Tissot meteorite, was only on the surface for a few weeks to months. And even then, I know some of the people who are studying that meteorite, and they say even with the short amount of time that it was on Earth before it was collected, that meteorite did pick up Earth life. And so it becomes a little bit difficult to understand, to answer the question of, well, is there Mars life in the samples in these meteorites, simply because it's all overlain with the contamination from Earth. But we do expect that the radiation environment during the transfer from Mars to Earth would be hostile and probably kill off anything that might be there.
With all of our budget problems and issues in planetary missions and, you know, what programs are going to be funded and what's not, what is your office working on? Are there any planetary missions being developed now that you're actually involved with?
Well, yes, we actually have two Mars missions currently in planning. We have the MAVEN mission, which will launch in 2013, and we have the InSight mission, which was just selected by the Discovery program, which is not a Mars program mission, but it's a mission that was selected by a scientific all planets research call, which was identified this mission to Mars as being the highest priority for that program, That one will launch, I believe, in early 2016. So there are two Mars missions that we're looking at right now. One of them is an orbiter, MAVEN, and the lander, InSight, will be landing at the equator. So it's sort of the basic Mars constraints, but it still has all the regular constraints for Mars. And NASA is also studying the concepts for sending missions to Europa that will require some additional, that will require system-level sterilization if we'd want to do a Europa lander or a close-in Europa orbiter. So those are not going to launch for a while, but they're certainly at the concept stage. That's when you really want to start integrating planetary protection. And, of course, NASA does have contributions to European ExoMars mission, the MOMA instrument, which is a mass spectrometer that actually will be detecting organic molecules, potentially. It's a life detection mission, the ExoMars, and that will be the, one of the life detection instruments on that life detection mission, which NASA has not done since Viking. So we do have contributions to other agencies' missions, and we also have several Mars missions of our own. So my life is actually quite busy these days.
So you get involved right at the concept in the very early stages of these missions. You're involved from the start, not as a Johnny-come-lately add-on.
That is absolutely the best way to implement planetary protection on a mission. If you design it from the start, it will be no different than designing the mission without, except that, I mean, that is, it imposes no additional burden to design a mission with planetary protection considerations in mind than it does to design one without, if you take up the considerations at the very beginning. It's just part of the process of design, and that will make everything go much more smoothly down the line. And we're certainly testing that out. We've been testing that out with both MAVEN and InSight and also the Europa missions.
We are at the end of the program. Do you have any closing comments or pearls of wisdom or concluding thoughts you would like to leave us with?
I always get asked this, and I'm never sure what to say when I'm talking with people on planes as well. I'm very glad we have the chance to talk about planetary protection. I hope that people will continue being interested and will be glad to know that the United States is acting responsibly as we explore space. And as we go out in the solar system, we want to make sure that we get everything that we want to get done, both the science of studying life in other places and also eventually the ability to colonize Mars by humans without having something nasty that we left there when we went on our previous missions.
Cassie, I want to thank you very much for giving us your time today, and it's been, as I said, really informative, and I hope we can talk again down the road and keep this topic going on the space show. It's been a real treat and a real joy to learn from you today, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking, and I'd be delighted to come back.
Okay.
Nice.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for today. Our program is back tomorrow evening with our regular time on Fusion Propulsion and 7 p.m. California time. And goodbye from Dr. Conley and the Space Show.